We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started. Hello, everyone. As usual, stay tuned to the end of the interview, where I'll give you some actionable insights that I learned from my guest. These insights are also in the show notes, and all of the show notes are over at theentrepreneurethos.com. As always, thanks for listening. Thanks for the ratings and reviews. Thanks for the tweets, the retweets, the shares, the emails. Jill, just thanks for everything. Now, on to my guest for today, Matt Wohl, CEO of Acceleration Partners and co-author of the book, Moving to Outcomes. Matt started out working in the movie business, first working on story development, then moving into the business side. He realized he liked to make sense of things, to pull things together, pull on strands, and implement a structure and order to everything. He left the movie industry to go to business school, where he met and worked with entrepreneur Robert Glaser. After business school and some years working at other companies, he returned to work with Robert, eventually moving up in Acceleration Partners to becoming CEO. In Acceleration Partners, Matt works on helping businesses grow by building relationships. He helps them set up affiliate, influencer, and other similar types of programs. Once established, businesses can expect to see 10 to 15% of their online sales come from affiliate partnerships. In order for a company to benefit from affiliate marketing, they need a good site and good conversion rates in order to maintain the partnership. Matt also explains why selling products through Amazon can be a major problem when trying to pursue successful partnerships. Now, let's get better together. Matt Wohl, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, excited to be here.
Well, thanks for being on the show. You know, we were talking a little bit before we hit record. You're the CEO of Acceleration Partners. You've actually written a book with the founder of Acceleration Partners, Robert Glaser, called Moving to Outcomes, which we'll talk about in a second. That's really cool. I love when people write books. I know sometimes it seems a little bit like, we need another business book. Well, yeah, actually you do. And my philosophy, and I'll love to hear your thoughts on this in a second. You know, I think if you learn something, do something, you got to share something. So that's just me. But before we get into all that and talk about what Acceleration Partners does and all that sort of fancy dancy stuff, what I like to say, of course, the first question is, tell us how you got to do what you're doing today.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I got to do this totally by accident. I'm one of those people who started in a very different place and zigged and zagged until I found my place. So I actually started my career in the movie business. I worked at movie studios, Disney, and some other places. I was involved in a production of a bunch of movies. after a while, decided that wasn't really where I wanted to be. And I went to business school to try to sort out my next step. And there's probably a lot of people listening to this show who've either gotten an MBA or thinking about it. And that's probably a topic we can get into it in depth in a whole other show. But while I was there, I met Bob Glaser, who you mentioned, the co-author of the book and the founder of Acceleration Partners. And he was just starting the company, and he was, looking for some help. So I did some work with him. And then I, after business school, I went out and I worked for a couple of other companies, technology companies, and I was bored and hated it. And he called me and said, I'm starting up, I'm expanding my agency. I'd love you to come and jump on board. And I did. So that was 10 years ago now. And I came on as vice president of client services. And it's been a wild ride since then. Then I became general manager, then I became president, then I became CEO last year. So it has been a very zigzagging process, and I'm happy to get into any of it, but it was not a thing where I had a very specific goal in mind and set out to achieve it at all.
So you didn't sit down when you were 12 in your bedroom and say, you know what, I'm gonna run, be CEO of this, thing that does affiliate marketing and this and that and the other thing, and that didn't ever happen.
Yeah. No.
Well, what?
When I was 12, I wanted to be like, Stanley Kubrick, and that was my original straight line goal, and then decided eventually that was right.
What movies did you work on? I'm curious.
Yeah, so I worked on a bunch of animated movies. A movie called Shark Tale. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about Will Smith anymore, but he's in that movie.
Yeah, you can. It's so funny because. I think this is going to be a touchstone moment for the world.
Yeah.
Because really, either way you think about this, like, violence is violence. Like, you can't just say, it's just a slap, right? Well, no, you can't say that. That's where I think people are going to start to think like, this is not cool. I mean, violence is violence. When you hit someone, you hit someone. I mean,
Yeah, well, we'll have to see what happens. Hollywood is a way of rehabilitating people who in other parts of society would be languishing in prison for the rest of their lives. But probably another episode to get into that. But, I met him a couple of times in the movie. He was a nice enough guy.
Oh,
so, I don't like to judge people generally. But yeah. So I worked on that movie. And then, I worked on some... of the movies that Disney was making with Pixar, Monsters Inc. 2 and Toy Story 3 and some of that stuff. But, I was not a very senior person, so it's not like my name is the front of the credits. But it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of interesting stuff going on.
But your name is in the credits.
My name is in the credits, yes. Huh. About 8 minutes into the credits.
So next time I watch any of those movies, because those are like classics, I'll just wait till the end. I'll be like, is he there? Is he there? Well, so what's super interesting is I have interviewed, I must say, probably 4 or 5 entrepreneurs that started out in the film industry and then moved over to being an entrepreneur, SaaS, like basically taking the creative part of their brain and moving it over to business. And it's just so fascinating to me because as an author, like you're an author too, a lot of authors that they never make the jump. Like that they're like, I love to write, and I literally they'll write 100,000 word books forever. And that's only half the battle. The next battle is someone's got to read it. Like it's not, is it really a book if no one reads it? So I'm curious, what part of your, in your either how you grew up or just your attitude just decided like kind of said, oh, well, I'm down this career, but then I'm going to jump over to business. Because again, like I must have interviewed almost 6 people that have done the same thing.
Yeah. It's, I'll tell you about my path, and I don't know if my path is the same as others. I think what I realized while I was working in the movie business was that I am very focused on making sense of things, right? I'm very focused on making sense of things, on creating structure and order, and kind of understanding, taking disparate threads and understanding them in a way that kind of makes sense. In the movie industry, you know, it worked for me from my job in the jobs I was in, because a lot of what I was doing was evaluating stories and scripts. And the dirty secret of Hollywood is that, you have this, people have this romantic vision that, oh, some brilliant writer sits down and creates this brilliant script, and it kind of is, then forwarded on, and it becomes a movie. And that's not how it works. These things go through analysis, and, they have 100 people that are breaking them down and making suggestions and putting them, breaking them apart and putting them back together. And a lot of it is actually based on trying to kind of figure out the foundational elements and how things need to be arranged to build a story that is going to work with the audience and be commercially successful. So in retrospect, I realized that what I was saying I'm good at, trying to take disparate threads and make sense of them, actually was what I was doing in my job in movie industry. Right. So it was pretty interesting. But then what I figured out was that there was this whole kind of veneer of artistry, the sexiness of it. and I wasn't getting any of that. So I lost the romantic drive that I think you need to really succeed in that business. But then I started to say, like, look, what I'm really interested in is, how do you make money in movies? And I got into financing and trying to figure out, like, if you make a movie for $1 million, how do you actually then turn profit, right? Mm-hmm. If you're borrowing this much money and you have to spend this much money on marketing, and when you put it into a theater, you make, $2 off of every ticket sold, and, what's the addressable market? Figuring out film financing is exactly the same at the end of the day as writing a business plan, right?
Yeah, for an entrepreneurial 100%.
Startup. And so that's where I started to kind of evolve more into the business world.
Yeah, because what's interesting about movies, and I think this is unique to movies, I can't think of another thing that's like this. They like pull a team together, build it, and then the team goes apart. I mean,
yeah,
literally it's like the ultimate startup kind of thing. It's like, we're going to start this up for 4 months. And then, and what's the thing I never realized, I have some friends that are down in LA. They're actually, were friends of my late wife, Jane. They were in the movie business. And when Jane lived down in LA, she was in that too. Like, just weird. It's a weird world down there. Like, it just makes no sense.
It's its own world.
It's, yeah. It is like, it's, I don't get it. And like, thankfully, like, that's not my, right. But what I always found interesting is, like, the credits start and there's like all of these names attached to this movie. It's like this production, that production, da, da, da. And I'm like, why are there so many people that are doing this? And then I sort of realized, oh, well, they pulled that, these sort of either production company or the financing or whatever, they have to pull together an entire team to make this thing happen. And then the entire team just goes away. And I got to believe, of course, people like to work with each other, and maybe some studios have a team that they just roll onto projects. Like, like if a TV show, like some of my friends like worked on TV shows. So they're like, we're in season 9. Yeah. Right. But it was still this literally freelance type situation where you didn't know, like, is it going to get canceled? Is it not going to get canceled? So it seems it's way more entrepreneurial than they get credit for. That's the thing I had a lot of respect for that.
Especially, yeah, it is very entrepreneurial that way. And actually it was kind of the gig economy before the gig economy, right?
Exactly.
The people in the technical areas, especially, the guys who do the lighting and the sound and all of that. I mean, they're all freelance for the most part, and they go from gig to gig, and that's how it's been for, 100 years. So it's an interesting thing. But the names that you see before the movie starts, three-quarters of those people had nothing to do with the movie. They just had some money that's how it goes.
Why? Because again, I've interviewed a couple, again, almost six that have transitioned over. And I think that environment is a very good kind of thought process. I don't know what the word, like, just it's like an incubator almost for, this is what a startup's like. I mean,
yeah,
you are 100% Like, you got to figure this stuff out. Like, you know, and I like why you brought the point up about, well, it's really not about the script. Like, yeah, this guy's got this great idea, but I mean, you know, we're trying to figure out how to make money at this. So it's a little bit different, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting when you put it that way. I mean, it's true. It is very much that way. I mean, even the writers are like their own little entrepreneurial venture, right?
Yeah.
Every time they write a project and they got to figure out, you know, who they're going to sell it to and, you know, who's, you know, how they're going to position it. I've never thought about it that way, but you make a really good point. I mean, it really is like that. But I think where it differs in a lot of ways is that every time, unless you're, you know, one of the mega successful people, every time you're done with something, you got to start over from scratch.
Right.
Right. Whereas at least, you know, if you're starting a company, hopefully, you know, you make a run, you know, you can exit, you know, you can kind of go to the next thing, but it's not like, you know, every year, you know, you're on to the next thing. I mean, it's a grind, and it's one of the reasons that a lot of people don't spend their whole, you know, they do it for a while, then they leave, because it's a grind, and it's kind of like you either love it and it's in your blood or it's not the right thing for you. But entrepreneurship is probably similar in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, you know, Jane, my late wife, who I've talked about a lot, like, she had all these LA friends, all these stars and these premiere, we'd go to these like premiere things, you know, up here in San Francisco and all this. And she just loved that. Like, oh, this is so great. And I'm just like, I can't handle this. Like, this is the worst. You know, I mean, I've, you know, met some famous people and stuff, like, but to me, it was just like, can we just go home? I just don't, you know.
And they put their pants on one leg at a time.
Well, like, and right. And what the thing I never knew in this, what I learned was that it's like the stars aren't important. It's these producers that like the ones that do the project. So they're like, they're the ones building these projects. And of course these actors are like, I want to be attached to, or whatever. I mean, this was back, you know, Harvey Weinstein stuff, you know.
It's still the same,
right?
You know, in a lot of ways. I mean, before I left the industry, I had a movie project that I was trying to get made, and I was going to produce it. And we had written a script and put a bunch of money into it. And the product had been bought by National Geographic Films. And we were pretty close to like getting it made. And then the president of National Geographic Films got fired, and the new guy came in and he got rid of all the old stuff. And so the project never happened. But, you know, it's true. I mean, it's like you're building your own little company every time you do these things, you put it together.
Yeah. And even the fund. So like to your point, the fundraising, the business plan, the vision, I mean, these are all very much aligned with building a SaaS product, building a hardware, whatever the it just to your point, which I think is valid, like it's a little longer burn, right? You're not, I mean, you're going to pivot, but the pivot is not, you know, I mean, I guess it could be a rewrite or whatever, but you know, and because the first time I heard about like writing on spec was Stephen Pressfield when he wrote The Legend of Bagger Vance based on his book.
Yeah.
And he's just like, yeah, this is that's what I was doing in LA, writing these screenplays, thinking, oh, yeah, I'm great. And it's like, this is what a slog, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know,
yeah. It's not easy.
No. I mean, it's, you know, I just find it so fascinating because that mentality is very helpful starting a company or even an agency or the hybrid. I mean, I'm not exactly sure, I guess, what Acceleration Partners does. So, I mean, not granted, I know a little bit, but I'd love to hear sort of the thought process of how that works. And then of course we'll talk a little bit about the book. Cause I think, again, it's so fascinating. These little threads, they sort of build on each other, I think.
Yeah, they do build on each other. And it's whenever I have these conversations, I pull out kind of something else I haven't, you know, really connected the dots on. So it's very interesting for me. But yeah, Acceleration Partners, we are the largest independent partnership marketing agency in the world. So we run a bunch of different kinds of programs for brands, but the ones that are probably most well-known are what are called affiliate programs. Mm-hmm. And so for those who don't know, an affiliate program is where you have a brand, you know, who's selling a product or a service online generally, and they want to work with a set of third-party publishers, people that have properties or assets online, So they build a program where those third-party publishers can promote the brand and get paid on a, usually on a commission basis. There are different ways to be done, but it's usually on a commission basis, some kind of performance basis, when there's a transaction or a lead or a new customer or whatever it is, whenever they kind of send the brand the thing that the brand wants. So, you know, affiliate programs represent something like 10 to 15%, they're different estimates, but 10 to 15% of all online transaction volume. And, you know, we run these programs for a lot of different companies, you know, Target and Reebok and Marriott, et cetera, et cetera.
So small companies.
Small companies. Well, although we those are the big ones. We do run programs for a lot of much smaller companies, just, you know, growth stage companies as well. Mm-hmm. But affiliate marketing is the kind of core of it. We also do influencer marketing. We can get to that if it's helpful, and you know, other types of like partnership development. So it's all kind of under this rubric of partnership marketing and building programs where you can work with partners on a performance basis.
And is there software involved? Like, do you have a platform?
There is software involved. It's not our software. So, well, I guess there's two kinds of software. So there are platforms that track and pay and keep all they have all the metrics and the reporting, right? Mm-hmm. So platforms like Impact or Partnerize or Awin or CJ, you know, they're different ones that people might know. Mm-hmm. And essentially they're the plumbing, right? So, right. If you're the brand and you're working with me and I'm the publisher, you know, you have a program that's set up on one of these platforms. I sign up on that platform. And so that way all the transactions can be tracked. You know how much, you know, how many customers I'm referring to you. I know how much money you owe me, and I get a check through the platform, or, you know, those platforms kind of run, they're the plumbing. And then we have our own technology that just helps with business intelligence and data. You know, there's some of these programs have tens of thousands of publishers in them. So there's huge amounts of data that needs to be managed. Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. So you sort of like facilitate setting these programs up.
Yeah. And then we manage all the relationships.
And the relationships. Okay.
Yeah. And you can imagine if you have 1,000 publishers in a program, right? And, you know, those publishers could be bloggers. They mm-hmm. could be sites that post coupon codes. Mm-hmm. They could be, you know, cashback sites like Rakuten Loyalty, you know, for people seeing their ads on the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. It could be CNN or mm-hmm. BuzzFeed, right? Or Wired. Those are all publishers in the affiliate ecosystem. There's the beauty of it is that, you know, there's a nearly infinite variety of publishers that brands can work with. And so, you know, a lot of it is figuring out the strategy of which are the publishers that line up with my brand and my brand story and can really represent us the right way in the market.
And how effective is this?
It's super effective.
It's super effective.
It's really effective. The general, you know, storyline, to harken back to the movie piece, is that these programs are never going to drive volume quickly, right? You can't start one today and expect to have lots of volume next week, because it's relationships. You have to go out and you have to build the relationships, it's a more like a business development kind of timeline, right? So, you know, if you're going to advertise on Facebook or Google, you can just dump a shitload of money into Facebook or, you know, Google, and all of a sudden, you know, pretty quickly, you know, you'll have volume because you're just putting a lot of ads out
right,
there.
Right.
It doesn't work that way because this is relationships. But once these programs get up to scale, again, they can often, you know, drive 10 to 15% or even more in some cases of a company's transaction volume. And very often it is, if not the most efficient, one of the most efficient channels that an advertiser has. Because what's really different about it is that in these programs, the brand is setting how much the price. They're saying, I'm willing to pay $10 for a new customer, or I'm willing to pay you 10% of a of whatever the transaction value is. And so because they're setting the price, they can ensure that the economics are beneficial, right?
Yeah.
On Google or Facebook or some of these other platforms, obviously they own the pricing model, right? And you either play the game or you don't play the game. And I don't want to claim that people shouldn't be working with them. You know, they should. It's just a different part of the marketing pie. But, you know, the economics can work really differently. You're not in control of the economics.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have my general heuristic, right? Like, I think ads, Google, Facebook ads are almost worthless if you're below a certain threshold of revenue. I think the one I use is if you can't spend $1 million a year on Facebook or Google ads, it's probably not going to benefit you. I mean, I don't have really any data to back that up other than the fact that I don't like ads.
And that's valid. I mean, I the pushback I would give you, so my wife actually has a smaller company and she does really well with Facebook ads, but they're incredibly narrowly targeted. Right. And I think that's the key. Like if you're a smaller business, I think you can do it if they're incredibly narrowly targeted, because you really know your customer. But in general, I as a general thing, I agree with you. I think there are a lot of companies that just assume they're going to throw money into Google and Facebook's, you know, black box, and all of a sudden they're going to do great. And I don't think it works that way most of the time.
Yeah. What business is your wife in?
She runs an online exercise program for people with autoimmune disorders.
Oh.
So it's like very specifically targeted at those kinds of people.
And is it like, so it's like, issues. It's like a subscription or? What's
yeah. It's a monthly subscription. Yeah. But it's just, it's targeted at a very specific person.
Yeah. Well, they always say the riches are in the niches, I think.
There you go.
Yeah. I think Russell Brunson says that.
Yeah. And I think, and part of that actually translates into what we do because, you know, with partners, you can find partners in all these different niches, right? And you can say, okay, well, that partner talks to that niche. And so I can very specifically, you know, tailor my copy or promotional, you know, material or whatever it is to that niche with that partner.
Yeah. So do you think, just I'll put you on the spot here, this affiliate as opposed to ads, if you're a startup and you're trying to figure out the best place to spend your promotional dollar, what do you think? What would be the mix? You know, like how do you think you should think about it? Because this is really important because I don't think a lot of people really truly understand this affiliate model. Or what I like to call advocates. Like I think advocates for your brand are the most powerful thing on the planet. If you and I are like sitting around, you know, hey, what's going on? You're like, hey, Matt, man, there's this great tool. You got to see it. 100 times out of, you know, what, 85 out of 100 times, you're like, oh, cool. You'll look at it. Whereas it's some silly ad, maybe not. Again, I'm biased. Full disclosure, I'm not a big fan. I see the value in them. Don't get me wrong. Like I generally think you have to experiment with ads because ads can tell you a lot of detailed data that you may not have. But I think startups spend way more money on ads initially than they should. And they don't spend enough on content or other channels that are like building what your point is spot on, building the relationship with the customer or a channel that's like more than just a transaction. And I think in the world nowadays, you know, ads are being arbitrage. Again, the reason why I use the $1 million thing is like, you got to have money to play that game. Like it's not like spray and pray. So I'm just curious because I get asked this question a lot and I don't have a good answer.
Yeah. And I assume when you say startup, you're talking about someone who's not, you know, not a startup that's raising many, many millions of dollars of venture capital, but a startup.
Well, I think let's break it out, right?
Yeah.
I usually like to say that between zero and let's say 5 million in revenue, annual revenue, right?
Yeah.
That kind of place from zero to hero, right? Like, I got nothing. Like that's the place, like usually where all my experience is. Most of my friends are in there. Like I don't, I know some people in the 100 million billion, but that bucket at that level, that's where, okay, I may raise some money. I'm curious how the mix should be and how affiliate programs as a channel, like, and then of course, I'm sure, I mean, of course you mentioned it applies to big companies too, which I think I understand a little bit more, but how about that?
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah. What do you think?
So here's what I would say. The thing about affiliate programs is that if you want to run them at like scale, right? Again, like I mentioned before, some programs have 1,000 or 10,000 publishers in them, right? If you want to run that kind of a program, you need to have a story that is going to resonate with all those publishers to say, hey, I want to work with that brand. Generally speaking, when you are in the $0 to $5 million bucket, you may have a great story, but those publishers have never heard of you, they have no idea who you are, and if they look you up, they're not going to find a lot about you. So it can be very hard to push a program at scale when you're at that size level. Now that being said, I think where a lot of companies find success, and we actually wrote about an example in the book, the company ButcherBox, if you're familiar with
them. Yeah, oh yeah.
Them. Butcher,
yep. Uh-huh.
You know, when they were small and starting out, they had a massive amount of success finding a relatively small group of publishers and influencers who were, you know, really aligned with their mission and you know, where the fit was there. And, you know, they did incredibly well with those folks and they really helped build the business in the early days because they found, as you said before, niches are riches. They found like a niche of people who were able to really deliver for them. And so what I would say is that for companies in the $0 to $5 million bucket, I think you're probably really much better off not trying to launch a full-scale affiliate program. You are much better off spending your time trying to find 10 or 20 really great partners that are really aligned with you, where you can build really solid, beneficial, long-term relationships that can really help move the needle for you. Because that's a number where you can really work closely with them. You can, you know, get them what they need. You can figure out the right strategies for each of them. And if they have a decent sized audience, it can really move the needle at that size. Once you get up into the $5 and $10 million range, then you can start opening up to a wider range of publishers, because then you have more of a story, you're more established, and you'll have a much easier time, you know, getting those guys to answer the call, right?
Yeah.
Versus when you're on a $500,000 run rate. So that's really my advice there. I mean, I'm not a full stack marketer, so I can't say, well, you should be like, you know, doing 20% Facebook and 20% Google. You know, I tend to agree with you that you know, those the return tends not to be there at that size. Mm-hmm. Although, again, unless you can really figure out a niche where you can get eyeballs at a relatively low cost, right? If you're just buying clicks for $25 a pop, you're probably not going to have a lot of success.
Yeah,
you know, unless your product is very high priced.
Yeah, no. I had that experience at this company I worked at, Sutro, where it was a direct to consumer plus distribution channel through pool stores, and literally we were looking at affiliate kind of like, what do they call it? Like advocacy programs. There's this platform called Zuberance. I think it's Zuberance. Anyway, I butchered it, but actually talked with them because the thing that's, again, you have to prove, and you have to like, how do you, and that was more on when you get a customer, building that customer into an advocate as opposed to an affiliate, which they had a little, I mean, it can
there's
get a little muddy.
In those things.
Yeah. There's some overlap, right? There's a little, it gets a little mudgy, like a little bit mungy, right? But I think his name's Bob. Bob wrote a book about it and talked about it. And some of his insights were exactly what you just said. It was more, you had to really think long-term strategy, prove that your model works, what works, what doesn't work. So just like any marketing channel, you don't know what works until you start.
Exactly.
Until it works.
Yeah.
And I love your point. Like it does, who knows? I think that a lot of people want this time certainty hack, right? Like, oh, we're just going to growth hack this. Well, growth hack what and how? Because there's some things this may not work on. I mean, are there things where this doesn't work, or is it, you know?
We tend to believe it's a how, not an if, right? Because like I said before, there's an almost infinite number of partners out there and publishers, right? So there's going to be someone out there that is a good fit for your business. It's just a question of finding them and figuring out how to work with them. And, you know, look, sometimes the economics just don't line up, right? I mean, it a lot of it depends. You know, what I was going to say before you started that, but it dovetails, is like, the thing that people have to remember is that these, whether they're influencers or whether it's BuzzFeed or whether it's a, you know, a blogger, whoever it is, they have, you know, the equivalent of shelf space, right? They can only post so many times. They can only run so many editorials. They can only do so many things. And so they want to make sure that whatever they are putting on their shelf to sell, right, or to talk about is aligned for them, is going to be something their customer is interested in, and has value. And I think what sometimes people forget, they kind of believe that there's, you know, that there's infinite shelf space. And so why wouldn't you want to, you know, promote my awesome thing? but if they don't know who you are, they have no idea what your awesome thing is, the chance of them, you know, taking something off the shelf, put your thing on the shelf, is going to be a lot less.
Yeah, a lot less.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's how we think about it. So to the point of what you're asking for before, like it's about, does it work for everyone? You know, it's about figuring out, you know, who's got the shelf space that you're going to want. And some of it is understanding your competitive position, right? If you are a company that sells, you know, a widget, and you have a competitor that's a lot bigger than you that sells a similar widget, right? But you think your widget is better for X, Y, and Z reasons. You know, if you can go to publishers and you can say, look, I'll give you a free trial. Here's one of my widgets for free. Try it out. And if you like it, write about it, right? That may get them to write about you instead of the other guy, right? Even though the other guy is better known and bigger company and maybe even can pay more, right?
Right.
Or if you're willing to say to that publisher, like, hey, I've got new updates to my widget coming out every month. I will give your readers, you know, your audience, access to them 3 days in advance of the general public, right? And then the publisher says, oh, wow, like my readers are going to love that. They're getting an offer that they can't get anywhere else. Again, they might then say that they want to put you on their shelf as opposed to the other guy. So you have, no matter how you're thinking about these programs, you have to think about this concept and like how you're going to get on the shelf. But again, when you're small, it's a lot easier to do that if you're limiting yourself to 10 or 20, you know, partners, as opposed to trying to do it with 1,000 at once. It's a lot harder.
Yeah. I think it's like anything of value takes time to build, like a relationship, exactly. like you said.
Any of these programs take 6 to 12 months.
Yeah,
is what we tell all of our.
Yeah, clients. Well, that's. I'm glad you brought that up, because there's no quick fix to this.
Yep.
The going viral growth hack stuff.
No.
Some people get lucky, and of course they're always held up to this high esteem. But I'm like, well, they're survivor biased. They're the ones that made it. They didn't get eaten by the saber-tooth tiger. Everyone else, the 1,000 to 1 that are all lying in the bone pile, like, you know, you can't make that correlation. That's the thing that always sort of bothers me about a lot of this stuff, especially when it comes to like, can you guarantee success, right? Like, because I don't think the outcome can be guaranteed. I think the effort towards the outcome you have control over. The actual outcome is not random, but a lot of luck, a lot of hard work, and a lot of more effort. But like, I think the thing that I've found, and I'm curious to get your take on this, is you have to experiment a lot to actually figure out which one of these methods works. And to your point about start small, build a story, like they're going to search you up, right? So if you don't have the basics, like good SEO, like a good landing page, a good story, like some, you need some heft, you need some ballast in that world to be like, oh, you're real. And like a lot of people ask, well, as an example, which sort of dovetails a little bit with this, like, what's the value of PR? What's the value of content? How come I don't see an ROI, quote unquote ROI, right? Well, some things you can have an ROI on, like this particular, you can see it. But there's just some things that are like fundamental to doing business. It's like the cost to play. And
yeah,
I think, I'm curious, what is that minimum cost to play to do something like this effective? Because again, I get asked this a lot, like, what content should I do? What kind of PR and marketing, you know, how am I going to measure the effectiveness of it? And I'm almost like, well, there's almost just the ante to be at the table. And what do you guys see when it comes to like, what's the ante to actually be successful at this? What do you need?
Yeah. So you need a decent site, right? And you need a site that is built to convert according to best practices. The biggest killer for these programs is you work with partners, they send a bunch of traffic and you convert at a 0.1% rate. Because they can see it. They can see that, oh, I sent you 10,000 clicks and you got one transaction, which means that I only got, you know, my one commission, right, for that one transaction.
Oh,
so we have had in the past, you know, some situations like that where, you know, we go out and we build these programs and there's real problems with the client's site, with their conversion funnel. And the conversion rate is just way below, you know, what you would normally expect. You know, I think pretty typical is like, if you're talking about content, you know, it's like a 2% conversion rate. If you're in retail, you know, would be pretty typical, 1-2%, right? Something like that. And so if you're converting a 0.1%, you're going to lose interest pretty quickly from publishers because they're not going to make enough money, right? They have to send massive amounts of traffic in order to make any money.
Yeah.
So table stakes is a decent site that converts well. And look, I think the table stake is having that you are selling something that people are going to want. You know, it's hard to try to get someone to kind of, you know, promote to their audience authentically something that, you know, isn't valuable. to be perfectly honest.
Right.
Now, you know, like obviously there are places where this happens all the time. There's like nutraceuticals and places where people just like throw something out there and, you know, and people will run it. But at least in the world that we play in, which is, you know, try a little bit more sophisticated, you know, I think that people want to see a differentiated product because it's much easier for them to promote and sell through. So I think those are some table stakes. And then another issue which people should be aware of is, are you selling on your own site and also on Amazon? Because if you were selling on your own site and also on Amazon, what will happen is you will work with a partner. That partner will write a great editorial piece about how great your product is. And then someone will say, oh, I'm going to go see how expensive this product is on Amazon. And they will go to Amazon. They will see that it is cheaper maybe on Amazon or they have Prime and they will buy it there. And A, you will make less money because you always make less money when someone buys your product on Amazon versus your own site. But B, you will end up in a situation where again, the publisher will see that they're getting lots of clicks and not a lot of conversions because the conversion path doesn't get tracked through Amazon.
Right. Unless they're right. An Amazon affiliate too, but then that's.
But even if they are, you won't see it. Like right. You won't even
yeah.
know.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
It's
yeah.
going to be totally separate. So, yeah. So a lot of companies fall into this trap where they spend time and money building these programs. Oh, but ultimately they don't work because, you know, 50% of the revenue ends up getting siphoned off via Amazon and they don't actually know what their return looks like at all.
Wow. So you really have to be very thoughtful and think
yes.
through all the conversion metrics and stuff, because I didn't think about that one. Yeah. I mean, what people are going to go like, look on Amazon to see if they can get it cheaper or Prime
yeah.
or whatever.
Exactly. Yep.
And that's not even captured. I mean, that's the whole problem with all this, like affiliate and capture and codes. Like I have the same problem with just, you know, attributing a marketing thing or whatever, some program, some campaign to a result. you know, because again, like this is the reason why everyone where there's just some basic things you have to do in order to run a business in the PR, marketing, and sales space that you may not even ever capture the quote unquote ROI on, because again, it's table stakes. It's like, this is what you got to do just to sit at the table. I didn't know that's really good. So client conversion rate, making sure that interesting. So yeah. So if you're a publisher, you got your, you know, you did your job, right?
Right.
And then their site doesn't convert. Do you then like help that customer or that brand, like help them?
We don't do conversion optimization,
right,
but
right.
We will say to them like, hey, we really think you've got a problem with your conversion funnel. And we would really recommend that you figure it out if you want this to be successful, for sure. I will push back though, I think, on you a little bit in that, you know, the whole premise of our book, you know, Moving to Outcomes, is that way more marketing activities can actually be tracked, I think, than people realize. And we believe that that will be more and more of the future. Mm-hmm. One example I'll give you is, in the book, we joked about how, you know, in the future, there might be a scenario where an agency representing a client buys Super Bowl halftime ad space, mm-hmm. runs an ad, and then charges the client based on, you know, how many customers are referred by that ad, and are simply arbitraging a Super Bowl ad, right?
Yeah.
So we talk about that in the book as like, you know, an interesting future state. And then lo and behold, Coinbase ran that ad with the QR code, right? Now, an agency didn't arbitrage that, but no. Coinbase knows exactly how many customers they got off of the $8 million they spent on their Super Bowl ad. They're probably the only company that knows exactly that.
Or right? There's, I think, first order and second order effects, right?
Yeah.
There's the first order effect, scan this code now, which depending on if it's real time, you know, and then the second order effect of how cool was that? Let me go check it out. Right. So that's savvy. That's actually really super interesting. I'm glad you brought that up, because the trend I'm seeing in the sort of agency world, right? What I do for a living, which has been happening over the last, I think, couple of years, but really started to accelerate, especially for startups, this whole idea of pay per performance, right? And so I think that's a really fascinating way to go. And I'm so glad you brought that up. And I can't wait to dig into the book, because, you know, outcomes matter. I know I always say like you only control the effort, which you sort of do. And of course, philosophically, but no one cares about that, right?
they want to see the outcome, right?
The money, right?
They want to know the return on that spend.
Exactly.
So it's an interesting space. There's a lot going on in the space at this point.
100%. Well, you know, Matt, this is such a great conversation. Thank you so much for being on the show. Can't wait to dig in and read the book. I think you're definitely onto something. I love the idea of affiliates. I've always thought that having people advocate for you is the best marketing spend ever, but it takes time and effort. And of course, like, play around, experiment, just don't, you know, be curmudgeon-y like me and say, it sucks.
It doesn't always work, you know, initially, but if you keep at it, you know, usually you can figure it out and find the right partners and the right approach. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on the show.
Appreciate it. Stay safe. Thanks again, Matt, for being on the show. I'm always so fascinated with the whole idea of affiliates and advocate marketing. I do think it's something that's always overlooked. And I also think it's a very powerful marketing channel. So as promised, here are some actionable insights that I learned from my awesome interview with Matt. One major benefit of using partnerships is that, unlike paying for ads, the business gets to set the price. You offer a particular percentage in commission, for example, and this number can change as your needs change. And I think this is actually a very good point that Matt brought up. In affiliate marketing, or, you know, when you actually say, hey, if you promote my stuff, you get a sale, I give you this percentage, that's a fixed cost, right? It's a channel cost. Whereas with ads, Facebook, Google, et cetera, those values of the keywords change. So there's a marketplace, right? So your cost of acquisition could actually go up wildly. So super interesting a way to think about it. I'd say the questions that you should ask yourself on this, which we'll get to actually in a second as well, is, you know, when will affiliate marketing make sense? Can I really have a good partnership with this person or this organization? Am I structured to do that? Can I set stuff up properly? I think those are some things. And we'll talk a little bit more on the next insight, right? If you're interested in exploring affiliate marketing for your business, it's all about relationship building, which is a long-term growth strategy, right? It's not a quick fix. If you're a startup doing under, say, like 5 million, Matt recommends starting with between 10 and 20 partners. Okay, so this is what I just was briefly talked about before. What's interesting here is that it is a valuable channel. It's something you need to nurture, but you shouldn't just go whole hog until you figure it out. Kind of like your product, right? When you're building your product, you kind of don't know what you don't know. You get some new, you know, customers, you sort of feel it out, and then you iterate from there. I think the same thing goes with this affiliate thing. So yeah, I mean, definitely pay attention to it. You know, ask questions like, you know, who are some people that I can maybe partner with and trust, that I can experiment with, that'll be a little more amendable if I don't got quite things quite right? Because, you know, never works the first time, right? So just think about that. Having a good website and good conversion funnels are two must-haves for affiliate marketing to work. Just as important, of course, is having a product or service people want and others will want to recommend. And I thought this was an interesting one as well, where, you know, affiliate gives you, gets the click through, lands on the site on your conversion funnel, and then the conversions are poor. Well, that's sort of on you, right? I think you definitely got to work on that. And I think that's the reason why, if you're starting out in this, again, to just kind of get some people you can kind of play around with, and like really it's low quote unquote risk, I guess, until you really figure it out. Because I think it's like anything, just like figuring out your product, like getting product market fit. I think you're going to need, you know, affiliate market fit, right? So there you have it. The actionable insights I learned from my awesome interview with Matt. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting theentrepreneurethos.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur, and frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at TheDailyMBA and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest you'd like me to talk to. Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about on this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.